34. I'm 48.
Ron, I mean, 48.
Yeah.
30 years younger than I. You come from New York?
Rhode Island.
Ron, before you start, just give me a biographical, little bit about you that I could use. What you, have you acted at all?
Yeah, I've done a lot of acting off-Broadway, mostly directing. Uh-huh. When I came to New York, 18 years ago, and studied with Sandy right away, and was already acting at the same time I was studying with him. And then started teaching. I come from Rhode Island. Is that the time you want to go back that far? I come from Rhode Island.
Yeah.
My dad's a butcher. My mom's a housewife. I went to my local high school and local college and studied English literature and acted in Rhode Island and then finally made the move to New York when I was 30.
What are some of the plays that you acted in?
I was a member of a group called the Working Theater for a very long time, which still exists and does a lot of plays about working people, kind of like the group did. Mm-hmm. And did a lot of lead roles for them, played young leading men, and in different Broadway, off-Broadway stages.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became a member of the Ensemble Studio Theater and started directing there, and I've been doing that for the last 10 years.
And does your wife work?
My wife's a massage therapist.
What is her name?
Bonnie.
Bonnie.
Bonnie Stetson.
I called you up so many times, I thought, well, you got mad at me because two situations. One, I did an interview with the neighborhood, but Pinter was too much for me.
Uh-huh.
Quite an interesting character. I did Pinter and Gary. Is that
Gary Kingston?
Both of them were nice, but I was so tired at that point that I just wanted to, I couldn't record. My first question to you, Ron, is how do you remember Sandy?
How do I remember him? God. Well, it sounds corny, but I kind of remember him like a father. He was my other father, sort of, you know. I mean, I have, of course, my own father, who was not a very sophisticated or cultured man. And I think sometimes in your life, you're looking for your spiritual parents, you know. And I think I found my spiritual parent in Sandy. We had similar sensibilities. He came along at the right time in my life, and I think I in his. He was looking for a teacher at the time. We got along very well, and we worked very closely together in a number of different ways. And I remember him fondly. I remember him as someone who took me under his wing and nurtured me and was interested in my development and interested in my family. I was a newlywed at the time that we met, and I remember him as a parent of a sort.
You know, Tony Randall also said Sandy was my father symbol, but he was a cold father, Tony said. He never praised me. All I wanted him to say was, Tony, you're a good actor.
Yeah.
But he would never do that, and Tony Randall said, I could never act in front of Sandy.
Yeah. I couldn't either.
Why is that?
I think that we would, at least I did, it becomes so important to get the approval of your acting teacher, especially when you're a young actor. And especially when I first came to Sandy as an actor, his reputation was enormous. So it was like if this man said you were a good actor, you were a good actor. If he said you were a bad actor, you were a bad actor. And it didn't matter whether you got hired, whether you worked or didn't work. It was only so he became such a colossus in your imagination that the end result of it was you became self-conscious. It became too important. So your sense of play, your sense of the joy of playing, which is a large part of acting, and just having fun, was overshadowed by your desire to get it right. And so you became self-conscious. I was a very good actor outside of his class, and a lot of what I know about acting is a result of him. So it isn't like I didn't learn, but I wasn't exactly free in front of him. As a teacher, I was free. As an actor, not so free.
Did he ever say to you, you were a good actor?
Grudgingly.
Mm-hmm.
Grudgingly. But he did tell me I was a good teacher.
But grudgingly, he said you were a good actor. You remember the situation, of course.
Well, little things. Things that are so meaningless that you know, like, I remember doing a scene one day in his class, and it was a domestic argument kind of scene. I was playing a character who just found out that my wife was unfaithful to me, and she comes home, I've been waiting for her, and we have this argument. And in the middle of the argument, for no reason, I picked up the telephone and started to kind of like pick it up and hang it up and pick it up and hang it up and pick it up and hang it up, like a man in distress who was touching things and he didn't know why. And at the end of the scene, Sandy says to me in that voice of his after his laryngectomy, "Why did you pick up that phone?" And I said, I don't know. And he goes, "That's acting."
That makes me, yes, that is acting. Instinctively, you
Yeah, I was playing for the first time.
Yeah.
So little things like that, he would tell me in those ways that I was a good actor, but never, you know, in a pedantic way. You have talent, young man. Nothing
no,
like that.
He wouldn't do that.
No.
Sandy has been described, you know, as a very talented teacher, but a difficult man. What do you think? Difficult man for people.
I think that Sandy's genius as a teacher lay in his ability to see the process of acting from a distance, and then lay out a system for giving that information to a young actor one step at a time, so that the actor was never confused or had too much information to deal with at once, and build that person up in a way that his genius lay in the delineation of the information. But his personality was he was regal.
He was what?
Regal.
Mm-hmm.
And powerful. And so his classroom atmosphere, as I described when I answered the last question, could sometimes be self-conscious making for the student. And I think a lot of his students did their best work outside of the class. And that his real genius was in, as I said, delineating the information in a way that people could absorb, but that his classroom atmosphere was not always free. However, I hear a lot of horror stories about Sandy in the classroom from people who came in contact with him much earlier than I did. When I came in contact with Sandy, which was approximately 18 years ago, he was older than the man that they met, and I think more genteel. We didn't have to call him Mr. Meisner, we could call him Sandy. We went to his house for dinner. Like I said, he was very nurturing and concerned about my family. I was a newlywed at the time. And I think from the stories that I've heard that the Sandy Meisner that I studied with was a much gentler, kinder Sandy Meisner than the earlier one.
Can you remember any of those horror stories from?
Well, the only ones that other people told me,
yeah.
You know, that he was impatient with bad work. He would become impatient with people who didn't understand him as quickly as he wanted. You just couldn't call him a nurturer.
Mm-hmm.
He was right, and you got it or you didn't, and you either succeeded or you failed, and he was not going to put his arm around you.
Mm-hmm.
It was up to you to take the information and use it.
Did he show his displeasure?
Well, not to me. You see,
I forgive these questions.
No, I'm happy to answer them. Mm-hmm. Not to me. He was very... He would do things where Sandy could sometimes sense that the class, for example, was getting a little too casual, not working hard enough, and decide that a good way to wake up the students would be to fire one student from the class publicly, so that everybody else would sort of go, "Oh my God, I've got to start paying attention, otherwise I'll be that person next."
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that firing of that student was a random, cruel act to wake up the rest of the class. In point of fact, it wasn't. Usually the student he chose to fire was somebody who shouldn't have been there in the first place, was a dilettante.
Yeah.
So he wanted to get rid of that person anyway because that person didn't belong there.
Mm-hmm.
So he killed two birds with one stone. He would wake up the classroom by doing it publicly and get rid of a student who shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, when you're a student in the classroom, you see this event with terror.
Mm-hmm.
But I, who was lucky enough to be trained as a teacher by him afterwards, began to see all these actions from an entirely different point of view and realized that they were not cruel, that they were quite reasonable and useful and successful teaching techniques.
Mm-hmm. He trained you as a teacher after you graduated from...
Actually, I was never a student at the Neighborhood Playhouse. I studied in Sandy's private class.
Oh, I see.
For 2 years. The class took place in the Neighborhood Playhouse, but it was a private class. Mm-hmm. I was not part of the Neighborhood Playhouse student body. Mm-hmm. And he began my teacher training in the middle of my second year as an acting student. Mm-hmm. So I was both an actor in training and a teacher in training at the same time.
How would he train you as a teacher, if I may?
Well, it started out by inviting me to sit in on the classes that he taught at the Neighborhood Playhouse. So mm-hmm. I would just sit next to him and watch the classes. And then I was so lucky, Bob, he put together a private class and rented a space from Jimmy Price, who had a space downtown at the time in Chelsea, who was also a student of his. And the class met on Wednesdays and Saturdays. Mm-hmm. And he taught the class on Wednesdays, and I sat and watched. And then we would go home to his house and talk about what happened in the class and why he did what he did and what my impressions of the students were and like that. On Saturdays, I taught the class and he watched me. And then we would go back to his house on Saturday afternoons and he would say, what did you do that for? Why did you do this? What do you think about this? Well, you know, I think you addressed that wrong, or you handle that student very well. And that went on for a year.
How nice he was.
What?
He was so nice.
He really trained me mm-hmm. as a teacher. A lot of teachers, he just hired them, threw them in, watched them, and critiqued them. Mm-hmm. But he put together a class for me, which we taught together.
Why? Could you answer that question?
I mean, I think about this. Why me? Why did I get that lucky? Why? And my answer, the best answer I've ever been able to come up with over the years is, I was in the right place at the right time, mm-hmm. and he just wanted. He knew that he was getting to the end of his powers as a teacher. He was frail physically, he was tired, and he couldn't teach as many hours as he used to. And frankly, he didn't like some of the teachers who were teaching at the Neighborhood Playhouse at the time. Mm-hmm. He would often say that I want the playhouse to close when I leave it, and I think the board of directors didn't want to close it. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, I can't close this school. I don't like who's here. If I'm going to leave my legacy to somebody who's teaching the Meisner technique, I'm going to take responsibility for the way they teach, and I'm going to do it now. That must have been in his mind, and I came along just then. Mm-hmm. So I think it's serendipity based upon where he was with his career and when I came along. And of course, I think we hit it off. He liked me.
He liked you.
He liked me.
Now, Sandy never had any children.
Uh-huh.
Did he think of you in some ways, the son?
He treated me very fatherly. I don't think he never said that he thought of me as a son.
Do you remember?
There was another guy in the class at the time who was observing, because I was in his class right when they were making the video that showed on PBS.
Kent Paul.
Kent Paul was in the classroom at the time. And Kent Paul encouraged me to go and be friendly with Sandy. Mm-hmm. To speak to him after class, something that I would never have done on my own. Mm-hmm. So there must have been some kind of conversations between Kent Paul and Sandy where Sandy would say to Kent Paul, I like that kid. Mm-hmm. And then Kent Paul would come to me after class and say to me, you know, you can approach him. He likes you. You don't have to be a... So I think there was something there.
I interviewed Kent about 3 weeks ago, him and Danny... Danny, I can never remember. He wrote the book with Sandy.
It'll come to me in a second.
Yeah, that's all right. It's not important. Just to ask us something.
Is this making sense, though?
Pardon?
Is this making sense, what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Just some inconsequential information which I asked you before. I didn't record it. Your hometown
was Warwick, Rhode Island.
Warwick, what schools did you go to?
I went to Pilgrim High School. I went to Our Lady of Providence Seminary, which was I was training to be a priest.
Did you think about that?
Oh, yeah. In my sophomore and junior year of high school. It was a priest training school. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered women mm-hmm. and went to a public high school, transferred to a public high school. And then I went to my local public college and studied to be an English professor. Mm-hmm. And of course, all that time I wanted to be an actor, and I was resisting it, and finally I admitted it to myself, and then I started acting, and then I moved to New York, and one thing led to another.
You never graduated from college?
Yes.
What's the name of the college?
Rhode Island College.
Rhode Island College. Did you always want to be an actor?
Yeah, pretty much.
When were you a student at this? When did you study with Sandy?
In, let's see, 80 and 81.
80 and 81.
It might have been 81 and 82.
That's all right. Yeah. Somewhere in between. Was there a different concentration teaching?
Sure.
In the first year? I'm not smoking.
I'm offering it to you. You want to know if there's a difference in the first year and the second year? There absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to lean on a line that I use when I talk to my students. When students are interviewing with me, and students ask me, what's the difference between the first year and the second year? And here's the answer that I give them. In the first year, we work on you. In the second year, we work on material.
Yeah.
So the first year is about creating spontaneity, de-suburbanizing the suburban, creating some kind of expressive artistic freedom, getting the actor in touch with himself and his own emotional life. The second year is about taking all of that and using it in the service of material.
Let's discuss a little bit the exercises.
Sure.
When you were there, did Sandy have repetition?
Yes.
And the purpose of all these exercises were?
I think that the easiest way to say it is to create spontaneous responding. Mm-hmm. We start with repetition.
Yeah.
In repetition, it's just two people bouncing phrases back and forth. There is no imaginary circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
It's me and Bob Meisner doing repetition.
Yeah.
So I'm just learning to become a spontaneous responder
mm-hmm.
to the stimulus that I'm getting. And then we add imaginary circumstance. Okay, now Ron, you are writing this Dear John letter to your girlfriend, and you've got to get it written before she comes home because you don't want to face her. And Bob Meisner, you're coming over this house to borrow some money, which you need for a reason. So all of a sudden you and I are doing repetitions, but we're in a very particular place. I'm doing something, you're doing something else. So we have an imaginary circumstance. All of a sudden we're acting. Because if acting is living in an imaginary circumstance, now you're in an imaginary circumstance. So it's not just me responding to you, it's me writing this letter who's got to get it done. So that colors the way I talk to you.
Do you use the same exercises?
Yes, essentially yes.
Mm-hmm.
In the first year, not in the second year, it's a little different.
Okay. Now Harold Baldry said this, who I like.
Yeah.
Sandy could tear people apart when they were doing the exercises. And really make them feel terrible that they would go home and worry about it for 3 days until they realized Sandy was right and they learned something. That was his genius, said Harold. You agree on that?
I agree that talented people always eventually realized that Sandy was right.
Yes.
Untalented people never got it.
Never got it.
But you can't do anything about that. I don't know that they realized it in 3 days.
Yeah. This is what Harold said.
Sometimes it would take a year.
Mm-hmm. Maybe longer.
Maybe longer.
Yeah, Sandy says it takes 20 years.
That's a different idea. Mm-hmm. He's right about that too.
What? Tell me that. Why is it?
What does it mean that it takes 20 years to become an actor? Because I think that of simply because you mature in your art in the same way that any artist matures.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with collecting life experience. It has to do with having a lot of plays under your belt. It has to do with just growing.
Mm-hmm. I wish I knew you 18 years ago, because I always wanted to be an actor. But with Sandy Meisner as my brother and the attitudes, my mother and my sister, I said, no, I'm a writer. I'm going to be a writer. But I acted after I was 55, and I found out I could handle myself. I was truthful.
Yep.
I tried to be truthful. I didn't know anything about Sandy's class, and I loved it.
It's true, though, don't you think, that most siblings do different things? They don't want to follow in each other's footsteps.
That's right. And we won't go into that after the interview's over.
But back to the 20 years thing, just briefly. How many times have you heard an actor say, I did that part when I was 22 years old. I'm 40 now. Now I could really do it.
Eli Wallach.
I think that's what Sandy's talking about. Yeah. Now I could do it, really do it. Because what you can bring to it 20 years later is so different than what you brought to it initially.
Were you ever the subject of Sandy's criticisms?
Sure.
Can you give me some examples?
My favorite criticism I ever got from Sandy was a day when I was visiting Sandy in his apartment with my son, who at the time was probably 8 or 9 years old.
He's now 27.
He's now 26, yeah. Mm-hmm. And something happened in the house, I don't remember what. And my son responded to it in a particular way. I can't even remember what he did. And Sandy looked at me and said,
you need his freedom.
You need his freedom.
Yes. Referring to the unselfconscious way in which my son, who was 8 or 9 at the time, did whatever it was he did. Mm. And Sandy looked at me and turned it into an acting lesson. Mm. He said, you need his freedom.
Did you understand what
I knew exactly what he meant. I was being self-conscious and uptight and, you know, stiff.
Was he married at that time to Betty?
Sandy, no. Sandy was with Jimmy from the beginning of my first meeting.
Yeah. Were you in awe of Sandy? Did you fear him?
Initially, yes. But after the encouragement I got from Kent Paul to make friends, and then the nurturing I got from Sandy as a teacher, we became quite equal in how we treated each other. I felt I could say anything to him. I could tell him a joke. I mean, he could tell me a joke. We went to ball games together.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I went once with him to the Mets.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so it
Dodgers
was.
Then.
So we'd never. It was a very familial relationship.
Yeah.
Eventually.
I wish I had it, but I didn't. I don't resent it.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't.
Yeah.
You know?
I have a kind of closeness to Sandy that I didn't have with my father.
Yeah.
But I certainly, there are some things with my father that I don't have with Sandy.
Is your father living?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you see him often?
Often.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You feel differently about him now?
Well, I could discuss things with Sandy that I couldn't discuss with my father. I could discuss art with him. I could discuss poetry. We could talk about things that my father had no understanding of.
Music.
Music.
You know that Sandy started out to be a pianist.
I know. I've heard some of his piano, and I knew that he played the organ in Bekwi for, you know, productions that they would do with the native people.
That's right. Yeah. He was loved in Bekwi. Really loved. And I spoke with my niece last night. Did you know my sister Ruth?
I did not.
Well, he was very close to Ruth. But let's not go into that.
Okay.
It was a student. I don't know if she was at your time. She's a paraplegic. Her name is Kathy. Then there was Kathy Morrison.
I don't know her.
Now it's Kathy Nunn, and she was very successful, and in 13 years of being successful on television, she got a part. She did Broadway. She slipped on ice and fell and had 4 operations as a paraplegic, and has a dance group, which is wonderful, called the Infinity Dance Group. She dances from her wheelchair and stuff. But she tells 2 situations about Sandy. One, when she was in class, right from the beginning, he said to her, set up an exercise where she lost something, I had to come in the room and look for it. And she did it, and he criticized her badly. He said, give me your ring. She had a gold ring that her mother gave her father. And he took the ring and he threw it out the window. And she ran downstairs, hysterical, and found the ring and came back to class. And Sam said, now you know. And the second thing she said to me was, and no one ever knew this before, she told me this, there was a couple in the class who were married, and they had a baby, and they used to bring the baby to school. And during rehearsal, Sandy said to Kathy, take care of the baby. And she took the baby up to the bench outside of Sandy's office, and Sandy then came up in the elevator, and he walked over to her, sat down next to her, and says, give me the baby. He took the baby and he rocked the baby and he kissed the baby and he cried like a baby. And he said to Kathy, don't ever tell anyone about this. That's what you said before about being fatherly there reminded me of that. Nothing, you have no comment on that.
No, I think that sounds like the Sandy I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Both examples, the throwing the ring out the window and the holding of the baby.
Yeah.
But he didn't want his students to see that, I don't think.
Did Sandy show much anger in the classroom?
You know, he was, as I say, I think towards the end of his career,
yeah,
and except for a few incidents where he really needed to snap the class out of a kind of lethargy that all classes slip into, he was quite genteel by comparison to some of the stories I hear about the way he taught when he was younger.
Mm-hmm. Did he show anger much in class? I may be repeating myself.
Well, as I said, he was quite genteel when I was a student, yeah, of his, except for a few incidents where he, I think, on purpose, once he threatened not to take our money,
yeah,
because the work was bad, and once he threw that kid out of class in that calculated way that I described earlier in the interview,
yeah,
and except for things like that, he was quite genteel.
Do you recall any students not called back for the second year who went on to have successful careers?
In my particular class with Sandy?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Now, Ron, what impact did Sandy have on you as a person?
Well, in every imaginable way.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's safe to say that he gave me a career. I mean, I'm a successful teacher in New York now with plenty of students, mm-hmm, and raising a family and directing regularly in New York on a off-Broadway level, and without Sandy Meisner, I don't know if that would have happened. He took, mm-hmm, me under his wing, he made me a teacher, and everything I learned about being a teacher fed into what I know about being a director,
mm-hmm,
so he gave me a career. Yeah, no, that's fine.
Of that tape.
He also, what I am as a person, my sensibilities,
mm-hmm,
for in a large part, what you learn in that acting class affects the way you live your life. I mean, I think that's probably true no matter who you study with, really, and no matter what kind of art you study. Whenever you do anything in that kind of depth, part of the process is self-discovery, is, seeing pictures in different ways, hearing traffic in different ways, relating to human beings in different ways. You become more aware in certain ways, and just become more sensitive. Sensitive meaning to sense what is real, not sensitive in the touchy-feely kind of way. And so he affected my life in every imaginable way. Now, to say whether or not I couldn't have bumped into somebody else who wouldn't have done the same thing, I don't know.
Hmm. You remind me of Sandy. What made Sandy's teaching so good?
It was clear. It was nothing vague about it. That's the most important thing to remember about Sandy Meisner. Not only Sandy Meisner as a teacher, but the Meisner technique. And I think that's where his real genius lies. It is clear.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple. It's simple truth, simple things that you can do that make a difference in the way you behave as an artist. As opposed to a lot of other classes which, the teachers are trying to do everything at once, It's like when you want to become a football player, first they teach you how to hold the ball, how to run, how to balance yourself. Not how to hold the ball, run and balance yourself, but first, how to hold the ball. Sandy could do that with acting.
Mm-hmm.
Hold the ball this way.
Mm-hmm.
Stand this way. Throw it this way. Okay, now do it all together. Don't try to do it all together at once.
Mm-hmm.
That's the genius of the Meisner technique and the genius of Sandy's teaching. You would never go on to the next thing till you had mastered the first thing. So you weren't trying to keep 17 balls in the air all at the same time.
He was simple.
Simple, clear.
What was the difference between him, can you answer this, and Strauss, or other teachers, Stella?
They were vague.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they were vague. I don't know a clearer way to say it. They were vague. They tried to get you to understand too many things at once.
Now, how did you hear about Sandy?
From George Firth, who is an actor and a playwright,
mm-hmm,
who happened to be an old childhood friend with the wife of a college professor I had in Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved to New York, this woman, whose husband was my college English professor, said to me, well, you've got to get together with George Firth. He can tell you how to handle yourself in New York. So he was a very famous, he wrote the musical company. He wrote the book for the musical company along with, I can't remember his name. And he wrote Twigs. Mm-hmm. And he was a big character actor in Hollywood. And he said, and I called him up. The first day I moved to New York, I called him up. And he said, well, you have to study with Sandy Meisner. I'll bring you to his class. And
what was your reaction when you saw Sandy or met Sandy for the first time?
Well, I didn't know how old he would be. Mm-hmm. So my first impression of him was that I had to listen very hard to understand what he was saying, because I didn't want to be going, what? I didn't want to, what? He had a bearing about him, Sandy, which was, he had an elegance, a personal elegance, and he was dramatic. I actually think that laryngectomy, you know, he was such a consummate actor, Sandy, that he used that laryngectomy to great dramatic effect, because he parceled out his words in a certain rhythm based upon his ability, his necessity of having to burp up the air that he needed to, mm-hmm. but you know, that contributed to the whole impression of this sort of elegant, sophisticated wordsmith.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you listen to Meisner, to Sandy, you would always be waiting for the next word to fall, because they would come so slowly. And it created a drama when you listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first impression of him was that he was elegant and dramatic, and he also reminded me of my Uncle Russell.
Your Uncle Russell?
My Uncle Russell, who was the most elegant man in my extended family.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have it.
That's a good answer. Did you ever hear Sandy talk about his family, about me, or his sister?
Well, of course, I heard all the stories about the death of your brother.
Yes.
At an early age, and
yes.
The effect that had on Sandy's childhood,
yes.
And growing up.
It's a horrible story.
He would talk about your parents as being warm and loving, but unable to appreciate the depth of his pain caused by that death.
Unable to.
Yes, in his opinion. I mean, of course, I never met your mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
I understood certain ironies in Sandy's life,
mm-hmm.
He would tell stories about your father, you know, when he was trying to make a point in class about, you know, some woman would come in and your father would, you know, find a secret way to blow on her fur coat to see if the fur was real or faux, or you know, stuff like that. So I got, you know, he was giving, you know, the impression of your father, who was always thinking business. He talked a little bit about growing up in Flatbush and what the neighborhood was like when he was a kid, and I thought that there were certain ironies that I would glean from. I'm actually changing topics. It was very interesting to me that Sandy was in the group theater during the Depression, which to my mind was a very political theater, talking about the common man, the working class man, the plight of the working class man. And yet at the same time, your family was pretty, it seems to me, well off from the
yes.
stories I get from your father was a furrier, so his customers were never really affected. So they were still buying the thing that he had to sell. So I always thought that was an interesting irony.
You ever hear him talk about me?
The one time that I met you was at Sandy's house.
Yes.
You were with a woman at the time she was there. I don't know who that woman was.
Neither do I.
Might have been a girlfriend that you had at the time. And all he said was, we were never very close.
No.
But in no detail.
No. He wrote in his book that he lost contact with me, which he never did. I mean, I loved it. I was, you know, he was an idol to me. So at the instigation of my kids, I went to Sandy's apartment on 58th Street, I guess, and I asked him, why did you write that? And he looked at me, and he looked at me for a while, and he said, excuse me, I have to get ready for school. And he went and he shaved, and he never did answer that question. In a sense, this book I'm writing will help me answer that question.
I am under the impression that Sandy lived very much in his imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And his family were his students and characters in plays.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's what you're asking, but...
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that is, but he seemed to carry around a lot of... I think he felt misunderstood as a child.
By his
and
parents.
And by his student friends in school, and
yes.
That he had a kind of a sensibility that no one recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, he closed off from them.
Yeah.
I think the same thing is true of his acting, Bob. I think that he always wanted to play the sensitive characters, and he was always cast as the somewhat villainous characters, and that he thought that I think he was sad and lonely. I think that he felt that there was a person inside of him that nobody got, and I think it made him angry.
Could have. His favorite part, though, was in Paradise Lost. Did you ever say that?
Well, that was the sensitive boy who was dying of tuberculosis.
That's right.
But then, you know, I mean, Mikey and Nicky, he plays this cruel, you know, and the lawyer he played in the story on page one, they always these, he had an impression that he gave to the world that he did not like,
mm-hmm.
that he did not think was him.
No.
And his type was other than what he thought it was.
Yeah.
I think he's wrong about that. I think he never came to grips with that. I think that he... probably was a bit more of a villain than he thought.
Yeah.
And I also think that he could have put the two things together. And he sort of didn't. He sort of just drew the curtain.
You said that Sandy in his later years became more human, is that the word?
More nurturing than what is the impression of him I get from people who encountered him when he was younger.
As a bitter man. A happy man.
Tougher. I would say tougher man.
Mm-hmm.
Not. I wouldn't say bitter. I wouldn't say unhappy, though I think he was unhappy and lonely. I think he was lonely.
Yes.
I think he was a terribly lonely man. But I think a lot of artistic people are. I don't think that's unusual in Meisner's case.
No.
I think artists are tortured.
Mm-hmm.
To some degree.
I think Sandy and I suffer from the same disease, I think it's a Meisner tradition.
I think it's an artistic tradition.
Artistic.
I don't think you can find, except for maybe Bach, any artist who isn't working out of some kind of pain.
Yes. I don't know if Harold told me this. Eli did, I think. Tony, that Sandy loved teaching more than acting because of the adoration he got from his students.
I think that's where most of his love came from.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it too as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that completely.
Yeah.
And I think that he was most comfortable with the company of young people.
Yeah. But yet, Sandy wouldn't even walk into a room with his nose or eye. You said regal.
He made entrances,
yeah,
but they were not without a twinkle.
Mm-hmm.
Your brother had a twinkle in his eye, and I think a lot of people, because they were students and afraid and deeply in need of approval, missed the twinkle.
Mm-hmm.
He had a wonderful sense of humor, and he was quite capable of performing himself and knowing that he was performing himself and doing it for effect. And a lot of the young people couldn't see through that. I was lucky enough to be studying as an actor and being trained as a teacher by him at the same time. So I could see the part of him that was, in fact, a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people didn't get it,
mm-hmm.
simply because they were afraid So some of the rap that he gets as a nose out of joint, cruel man is being put on him by young, scared people. But when you sit next to him and you get what he's doing, a lot of it is what's the word for it? He's being a rapscallion on purpose. And he knew what he was doing, and he knew why he was doing it, and some people just didn't get it because they were afraid. They needed him too much. But once you sat next to him, you could see the twinkle. He would lean over to me and say, "Ron, watch this." And then he would do something and everybody would quiver. And then he'd look at me and wink.
He says, "I've heard that before."
And he loved his students. He wanted them to succeed. He wasn't there to break them down. He was, unlike a lot of teachers, very happy. I think that if Sandy Meisner knew that my teaching was just as effective as his, I'm not saying it is, he would want me to be better than him. He didn't want to hold me back.
Yeah, I understand. Ron, do you think Sandy was capable, this very sensitive guy, of expressing his love?
Depends on what you mean by expressing love. There are so many ways to express it.
To say I love you. Don't answer that if it's a joke.
He never said, "I love you," to me.
Yeah.
But he did a lot of things that let me know that he did.
Yeah.
Now maybe that's my fantasy. Maybe that's, I'm making that up. But he would pinch my cheek. He'd put his arm around my son. He'd ask after my wife. He'd laugh at my jokes. He'd be curious what my opinion of things was. He treated me with love.
Yeah.
He treated me with love. He was not gushy. He didn't gush.
Does Sandy's bisexuality cause him problems?
Cause him problems? Not that I saw.
Okay.
They certainly didn't cause any problems between him and I. But look, he's a lusty guy.
Yeah.
The theater is a lusty business. It's a lusty world.
You didn't know Paul Morrison, did you?
No.
I once had lunch with Paul Morrison. Sandy and Paul were, of course, lovers and friends. And Sandy to the dangers, I guess, of Paul. And I had lunch one day with Sandy, with Paul, around the corner from the neighborhood, thinking about my son. And Sandy and Paul must have had an argument. Was Paul Morrison, very mad. There are only two things Sandy Meisner was interested in, sex and money. That was Paul Morrison.
I don't know any actors that don't have sexual issues. Sandy used to have fights with Jimmy.
Yes.
You know, and one, I can remember Sandy saying, telling me, "Get the Yellow Pages, find me a hotel, I'm moving out."
He said that a lot of
times. "We fight too much." And then 2 days later, I would bring it up to him and I say, "Do you really want me to find you a hotel? Are you really saying that? Do you mean it? Or is that just in the heat of the moment?" He goes, "Why? Because Jimmy and I fight all the time." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "How do you know I don't like it?" And I thought that was really bizarre.
But fantastic.
But after 16 years of marriage, I know exactly what he means. You live with somebody for 16 years, you'd rather fight with that person than be giddy with somebody else.
Yeah.
I understand that.
If there's something Sandy left you with, and you've answered many ways, what is it? If there's one thing that Sandy left you with.
I think, it's going to sound corny, but as a teacher, as an actor, and as a person, Sandy left me with the courage to cut through the crap and get to the heart of the matter, no matter what the situation was.
Yeah.
I don't, like I did when I was younger, get caught up in all this unnecessary stuff that makes it difficult to see clearly.
Yeah. Sandy was a pretty private man. He wasn't with you, who he liked. And so do I, by the way, Ron. I like you very much.
Thank you.
And I think this interview is so good, it's gonna create quite a lot of problems for me, and, you know, representing it on paper. I'll tell you why they did it.
But I'm sure that there were things that Sandy never told me. I mean, he wasn't, I mean, there are private things that I wasn't privy to, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, you never had any problems communicating with Sandy, of course.
I didn't.
Ron, I have nothing else to ask you except this one question. Is there something I didn't ask you that could help me understand my brother a little bit more than I did now? You said something when I came to the apartment. He turned to you and said, "We're not very close." I know we're not very close. We weren't until the end. About a year before he died. See, I couldn't hear Sandy. I couldn't understand Sandy when he spoke, because I have a hearing problem, and I couldn't understand his guttural bass voice. And then I'm deaf too.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
So Sandy, Jimmy called me up one night late, calling for Sandy, and he said, "Sandy wants to know if I love him." That was Sandy. And I said, "Of course I do." And I asked Jimmy if I should come out. And Jimmy says, "No, please don't have to come out." Doris Blum said to me, "You should have gone out." And now I resent, you know, I feel badly that I didn't go out, because I could have crossed some of those lines.
Life is full of that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our art is somehow made out of the pain that we collect from missed opportunities.
Why aren't you? You can turn it off. We don't have to. I want to thank you.
Oh, and thank you too. I'm just part of Sandy's public memory.
You have really one of the best interviews I've done. I much better than some of the so-called personalities who don't really speak as honestly as you do, and I appreciate it very much.
I loved him.
Just tell me about you love Sandy.
Yeah, you were thanking me for the interview, and I was just saying I was happy for the chance to contribute to his public memory, because I loved him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I cried terribly when he died, and he gave me a large part of who I am. You know, every once in a while you bump into somebody and they do something, and then it makes your life turn a corner, and then you wake up 10 years later and you go, "My God, if I hadn't bumped into this person, where would I be?" And Sandy was that for me.
What makes me so sad, Ron, is now that Sandy's been dead for almost going on 4 years, I find a closeness to him that I wish I had when he was alive. You understand that? And tears can come to my eyes right now when I think about my brother Sandy. And this is part of the book that I'm writing, to find this closeness I had.
But that's the way you love each other.
Yeah.
Life just handed you those circumstances that made you love each other from a distance, I guess.
What was Sandy affect the theater of today?
Well, it's hard to say, because that's a very, very hard question, because I think that a talented actor is going to find out how to act no matter who they study from.
Yes.
I don't think that you can say that any... I think Eleanor Dusa was the turning point from a kind of theatricalized acting to a more realistic style of acting that's from her till now has come to what we are at now today in the Western world as actors. That kind of simple reality, truthfulness, la-di-da, like that. Sandy is only one practitioner of that. I think really talented people are going to get there because it's the style of the day, no matter who their teacher is. However, what Sandy did do was, and his great genius was, in delineating the information that helps you get there in a clear way. So he cuts through the crap of it so fast, as a result of which his technique has currency now and is being used all over the world, and certainly all over America.
Mm-hmm.
So he has affected the theater by understanding the direction that acting took and delineating it in such a clear way that everybody uses it.
Everybody uses it.